Mike Malevsky for Radio Free Palmer. The following program is a panel discussion focused on bridging the gap. Paul Thomas has assembled a panel of participants who I think you might find to have some interesting observations of how we exist at the present time in different camps and what might be done to allow us to talk and listen across the divide. This is a special program, one of a series that will be appearing from time to time. I hope you enjoy it. Let's begin.
Welcome to KVRF Radio Free Palmer's first in what we hope to be a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining the issues that have divided us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. Before introducing the rest of our participants for today's discussion, I'd like to share with you all the mission statement which brought the effort together. Here's the mission statement. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. That said, I'd like to introduce the panel: Pat Chesbro, Lynette Cooper, and Charles Hayes, all celebrated figures in their own right. We are not here today to promote anyone's celebrity. We are here to explore ideas which may help us all out in the long run. That said, on to the first question. And this question was originated through a discussion we had as putting this together through Lynette, who asked at one point, what kind of society do we want? Pat.
You know, I was just watching an ad for a person who was running for office in Pennsylvania, and I was struck by him saying, let's make America decent again. And I think we want a decent society. And I think one of the things that divides us probably is that we disagree as what decency actually is and what power and glory and those kinds of things are. So I think we need to work for a decent America, one that treats people well and that gives everybody a chance. And if they need another chance, give them another chance and try to work to make us all listen to each other.
Charles, same question. What kind of society do you want?
Pretty much, I want a decent society also, and one where there's equal opportunity, and where, I mean, I'm old enough to recall a time in the 1950s when we were more together, while at the same time we were still divided, but it wasn't as well.
Well, what was the nature of that division in the 50s that you're referring to?
Well, we were very ignorant people, as we are now, in a way, about a lot of things, especially about human behavior and how bias works and how we get along. Right now, we're in a situation, in my mind, where Marshall McLuhan was right when he said this media was, in effect, retribalizing the world. That's what's happening right now. And people are gravitating towards echo chambers. And I don't think we're as divided as it appears if we could get together and talk out these differences. But I remember when the GOP used to be people, in my mind, that used to do the right things for the right reasons instead of putting party first. And I don't think that's the case anymore at all. So,
Lynette, what kind of society do you want?
I want a peaceful society, and I don't think that's really pie in the sky type of thinking. You know, I think we all really want the same things. We want a good quality of life for our families. We want good schools. We want to be able to raise our kids, you know, and just have a good, you know, American way of life, you know. And I think a little bit of what Charles was saying, you know, there used to be a time when there wasn't a them against us type of a thing, you know, Democrats against Republicans, you know, but it's really gotten fractured, I'd say, in the last couple of decades. And I think you really need to peel back the layers, you know, and just think a little bit, why has it gotten that way? It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, when you peel back the layers and see who's really pulling the strings and what's really going on and what their motives really are. You know, I think people will be really surprised.
Who do you think's pulling the strings?
Well, I think it's a lot of the billionaires and millionaires, and they have their own reasons, you know. And a lot of people aren't really, you know, I don't want to say not really paying attention, but it's easy to get waylaid by the media, you know, whether it's social media or network television. It's really easy just to, you know, be influenced by a blurb, you know, a soundbite, you know, soundbite politics. That's really big. You know, it's so easy. It only takes a few seconds. And they know that, you know, when they're coming up with all these programs and different campaigns, you know, on how to get people to vote their way or think a certain way. They know how easy it is to sway people. And I don't think it's that difficult to do a little bit of homework. You know, when you hear a subject that comes up that you don't really know much about, just do a little bit of.
Pat, you have something?
I just was going to add that it's also the language that we choose to use. It's not, I don't think it's only the media, but I think it's things like calling essentially some way to invade the privacy of U.S. citizens, the Patriot Act, and calling, and actually even calling, I was thinking about this the other day, calling the Affordable Care Act Obamacare, to try to play on the idea that people don't like Obama, and so obviously this is a bad thing. I think that
using phrases to demonize.
Using phrases to demonize or to
deify.
Yes, both.
Charles.
Well, when I think back to the 50s, during those times, racial prejudice, people were quite open about it. You could cut it with a knife. Now, they're not open about it. They cover it up, and it's harder actually to deal with because you can't nail it down. You can't get anything where with it.
But it still exists.
Oh, absolutely. It still exists. And my thing I focus on all the time is that we are primates. We are animals. We are human beings, but we are primates. And we have a chemical factory up here in our heads, and it secretes oxytocin, adrenaline, testosterone at the drop of a hat. That's the way we operate. And we have to take that into consideration all the time when we're relating to people, because we make up our minds about things in milliseconds before our conscious mind kicks in. And then we spend a lot of time trying to rationalize what it is our subconscious knows and is trying to keep from us. And we go around in circles and we never deal with the issues that we really need to deal with.
Getting back to what Lynette said and what Pat added to that, basically what we're talking about is quite Orwellian. If anyone here has read 1984, one of the primary themes in that book was the use of slogans and the use of deifying, in that case it was Big Brother, and demonizing anyone who was against Big Brother. And I certainly think we're seeing that today. But moving on to the next question, there was a term that is floated today, and it's called income inequality. And I'd like to introduce a related phrase that may produce other ways of looking at the issue of rich and poor. And that term is economic justice. Is economic justice a legitimate possibility for American society or even the global community? Do we have a chance of seeing economic justice? Does it exist? Lynette?
I think it does, and you can see it all across the country now. One avenue is the minimum wage. That's in the news now. If you take a look at Seattle, raising minimum wage, a study just came out about that and how, you know, for years and years, you'd always hear the conservative side saying, no, we really don't want to raise the minimum wage. You're going to lose jobs. You're going to this, going to that, you know. And what ends up happening is those people at the lower levels making minimum wage have more money in their pockets to spend. And so they're patronizing businesses in the community. They're working fewer hours because they don't have to work two and three jobs to make the same amount of money. So, you know, I think there really is going to be a big change, you know, and that's a big way to help with the income inequality.
So minimum wage is a start.
Oh, yeah.
Charles, before I let you come in on that, I want to remind everybody that what we are doing here is having a political discussion about the issues that divide our country in hopes of achieving solutions to those issues. Charles.
The notion of living wages is inevitable because our app economy and digital technology is moving us towards a situation where more and more jobs are being handled by robotics and by apps. And, you know, an Uber economy is not going to pay mortgages and provide a living wage. We're going to have to get to a point. There are some estimates right now that in 30 years, we might have 40 to 50% less payable jobs than we do now. Just because, think of what would happen if driverless cars and driverless trucks really start to take hold.
So what do you think is going to happen whenever the automation and the robots and the driverless
We're going to have to find a way to tie a tax to productivity, technology, so we can take back some of that money and have a progressive income tax. And we're going to have to figure out a way to fairly distribute income.
My question had to do with more with the, what are the people going to be doing? The jobs are taken over by robots. What kind of jobs are we going to have in this future society?
There's all kinds of things to do that need to be done that aren't getting done. I mean, with child care and elderly care, there's all kinds of things to do that don't pay enough money to do them. We need to rethink all of those things and rethink our priorities and rethink what kind of society we really want to live in and what makes life worthwhile.
So you're thinking that more of the service industry, medical service primarily, one of the places that future employment could be derived from.
That's inevitable with the aging demographics. I mean, that's becomes more obvious every year.
Pat, is economic justice a legitimate possibility for American society? First of all, let me ask, do you think that we have economic justice currently in our society?
I don't think I think we're going the wrong way with economic justice. In fact, and I'm very concerned as I look to the future with the fact that, first of all, unions are, you know, unions are going away in many ways, so people can't stand up for what they do. A living wage is not the minimum wage most places. People can't survive on that. And we have this disparity. And what's happening, in my opinion, is we've got people now working without any safety net at all. Maybe Social Security, but, you know, they're going to try to mess around with that. So we've got no safety nets. We don't have pensions. We've got people that are going to be elderly. We're talking now, some people are talking now about getting rid of Medicaid, which pays for a lot of people to be cared for as the elderly. And so we're setting up a whole generation of people to not be able to afford to be elderly. And who's going to take care of them? Their children. So their children then need to even make more money if they can need to support their parents. So I think the whole economic justice thing is we're going down this track that I think and we're rapidly increasing going down the track. And then we have people that are, I guess I would say, greedy. You know, no amount of money is too much money. Why do you need to make $12,000 an hour? I mean, you can't spend that kind of money. And it destroys the economy because how many cars are you going to buy? You're going to buy maybe 100 cars? You still only have 4 tires per car. You know, we're greeting being so greedy that we're just going to destroy the whole
thing. Whereas if that $12,000 was distributed to other people, they would be spending that money on things that they need,
yes.
thus circulating it in the economy. Yes.
Yes.
And why wouldn't you want a living wage for your neighbor, your friend, your relatives? I mean, even if you don't care about those people, think about your kids coming up. They're going to need to make a decent wage to be able to support a family or have a decent living lifestyle. So,
go ahead.
Except I think that that is somehow not – I think there are people who are convincing themselves that those I deserve it and you don't. And I think that we see that more and more. I mean, we see it with some of the things people say. You know, people are choosing to have diabetes. People are choosing to not have any money. People are choosing to live in places that we might not want to live. People
choosing
are choosing
to have pre-existing conditions.
Yes, choosing to not have a car so they can get to work. You know, but people, we're othering people, I think, at this point in time. We're not looking at them as our neighbor, as people we care about.
Which brings us back to your point, Charles, about the tribalism.
Right.
You know, anybody that is not in, anybody who is other is in the other tribe. Right.
Well, when I entered the workforce, minimum wages were living wages.
Mm-hmm.
And the progressive tax rates that enabled a very wealthy lifestyle were very high. Corporations paid about 30% of the tax, and that's down under 10% now, and one out of four pays nothing. So we have distributed wealth upward for 40 years at a pace that's growing exponentially.
I'd like to throw another little phrase out here, or a little sentence, and that includes economic justice. Economic justice includes affordability and requires accountability. But with the economic justice affording or having affordability within economic justice, what we see now is people, and I know this is the case in Anchorage, and it's starting to creep up here in the valley too, where people have to pay so much for their rent and their mortgage that they don't have anything else that they can spend on, as far as food and kids. Go ahead, Charles.
It is no longer possible in any of the 50 states for a person making minimum wage to rent a two-bedroom apartment.
Working 40 hours a week.
Yeah, so that kind of throws affordability right out of it. Hmm. So basically what we're saying is that anyone who has a minimum wage job, minimum wage income, is not really able to live in this society anymore.
And that we accept this while watching our public corporations being looted in the open with $100 million parachutes and golden parachutes and all. It's insane. I mean, you wonder how we ever got this far. I mean, it just seems to, I can't believe that people look at this and think that this is normal.
Well, you talked about the greed aspect of it. It seemed to me that seemed to come onto the scene back in the 1980s.
Gordon Gekko, greed is good.
Yeah,
everyone remembers that.
Right. Yeah. Okay, I think we need to let everyone know, all our listeners know, that we are engaged in a discussion here to try to understand the roots behind our political divide in this country. And we can discuss that political divide in terms of someone who voted for Trump, someone who voted for Hillary. And at the end, hopefully come up with some ideas on how to bridge that divide. So I have another question here that comes into the area of the leadership, the authority that we have in this country. And that is this. Is there a problem when the president announces an event that never occurred or is untrue? Is that a problem? Because it seems that for a certain amount of the populace, that just seems to be okay. Pat?
It's not okay with me. I'm a teacher. I was a teacher for years. I got employed as a teacher for years. I still consider myself a teacher. And I worry the most about the messages we're sending to our children about what's okay and what's not okay. I think that for a human being, a man, or a whatever, man or woman, who feels so threatened by the truth that the lies keep coming, I think it is I think it's a sad statement on the person, but I also think as a model for everybody else, it's very scary, and it does not bode well for our country or our children.
Have you ever engaged in a conversation with anybody about that, about how you can accept the fact that there are untruths coming out of his mouth, and yet that's okay?
I think that one of the, and as we get into what is dividing us and how are we going to solve it kind of issue, I think I have to examine myself and figure out what is my stance when I would ask such a question. Because asking a question that implies that I have the answer and you don't, I think is one of the problems we have right now. Rather than being able to ask a question that doesn't imply the answer that I want, I need to be able to listen to somebody and find out what they actually are thinking about it. And I think that's my personal struggle.
Okay, so you don't really have a question that you could ask in that light yet. You haven't articulated it in your mind as to how you would pose that question to initiate the conversation?
Right, I haven't figured out how I would do that in a way which truly was seeking understanding versus trying to set somebody up so that I could respond.
So they could be belittled in
something
some sense.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. Lynette, what do you think about that?
You know, I was just thinking back to the primary with the 17 people that were running, you know, on the Republican side, and how we all thought it was funny. Trump would take down his opponent, you know, and everybody got a good laugh out of that, you know. But now this is serious business here. This is no joke here. This is our country. This is our reputation on the line here. We used to be number one in a lot of things. The rest of the world used to look to the U.S. for guidance, but not anymore. Even our allies are running from us. They're afraid to engage with us. So this is really serious here, people. I mean, this is nothing to laugh about, whether he's releasing a video the other day about CNN or whatever, World Wrestling. Who does that? I've been following politics since I turned 18, so I try to stay on top of what's going on. I've never seen anything like this before. Never, ever. It's really shameful for our country to be put and to be looked at in this light now, you know. So something really has to change. It's got to change.
So engaging a person who, say, voted for Trump or still believes that Trump is good for America at this point, how would you begin the conversation?
Why do you think he's good for it? What has he done? He hasn't done one thing he's promised. He's gone back on all his promises. He's said he wasn't going to touch Medicare, Medicaid, any of those things. Social Security, he's talking about touching those. Affordable Care, look at where we are with that. You know, hasn't the jobs at Carrier, he said he was saving all those jobs. I was just watching an interview with the union rep there. He was talking about all the jobs that are actually being shipped overseas, and that money that was given to Carrier, they're going to use that money to update the automation, to eliminate more jobs at Carrier. So that was a lie. I mean, you can just go down the list, lie on top of lie. I mean, that's not right for a president to do that.
So it doesn't sound like Lynette has anything that is going to result in...
Just look at the facts. That's all I say.
Right.
Look at the facts.
Okay. Charles, what do you think about that?
I think the amount of dishonesty right now in politics is unprecedented in my lifetime. I think it's horrendous. I think our media is not doing... They're doing a little bit better, but they're not doing near the good enough job.
When did that start? It didn't happen with just Trump's arriving on the scene. It was prior to that, correct?
It's been going on for a long time. It's been sliding downhill, but the primary was horrendous. That when Trump stood up and imitated a person with disability, I mean, I still can't get over that. I can't get over how we elected somebody who would do something like that.
Lynette?
And when you have the head of CBS, Les Moonves, comes out saying Trump is bad for the U.S., but he's good for CBS, and all they're looking at are ratings, what does that tell you?
So money is dominating the scene. Go ahead, Pat.
Well, I think that's back to the greed thing. That's back to Citizens United. That's back to the corporations being the ones who run everything. The corporations don't have morals. You know, we have to be very careful about what we're saying and what we're doing, and it is terrible. And you know, obviously you know, they've been trying to paint Hillary Clinton with a brush for 20 years because they had an idea she might run for president. And so they've just built up all of this stockpile of, well, she's dishonest, she's this, she's that, and all those kinds of things. Personally, I think what the media should do is stop with the tweets. Don't put them out. I know they're going out to people, but they just, because we put them in then in the media, even people who are not on his tweet list see it. I think they should just, you know, we're not going to put that out anymore because that's his way of stirring the pot all the
time.
Focus
on the things he's trying to distract us from.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay. Talking about what you just mentioned here, this social media, I would like to get your opinion on whether social media and other internet sources have affected our current situation positively or negatively. Let's start with you, Pat.
Well, I think what's affected it is not, I think that we are not good at deciding which is a real source and which is a fake source. You know, I don't want to use the president's words, but which are just trying to keep things going, or which are actual honorable journalistic kinds of things. You know, I like social media. I like being able to connect with my kids on social media, people that live across the country. I like to see what my cousins are doing. I like those kinds of things. However, if you just go down the list and you look at the things that are inflammatory, we have to be able to, in our minds, choose, you know what the source is. I remember when I taught 10th graders, we were, you know, what is a reliable source? What would you use on your paper? What is, you know, when Wikipedia came out, is that a good source? How do you determine that? I don't think people are very discerning, I guess, about the sources that they use to cite.
And that has led to the tribalism? The fact that the lack of discernment that you just mentioned?
Well, yeah, but in social media, when we wind up in echo chambers, we participate in what's called ideological amplification. A group of liberals will go further left, a group of conservatives will go further right. We distance ourselves so much that we don't appreciate that left and right are both, you know, both necessary. I mean, genuine conservatism is simply conserving that which should be conserved. I mean, you know, valuable. We should have conserved the living wages in the 50s. We didn't do that. It's become a matter of identity. It's reasoning or relating. If you're reasoning, you're looking for methods and facts and ways to fix a situation. If you're relating, it's just us versus them. And you can't reason with a person who is relating. Their tribal attachment is emotional. It's not reason. So you can't talk them out of what they think. And any facts you offer will just be ignored.
That leads me to my next question. But before I go there, I want to remind our listeners that we are having a political discussion here about the divide that has occurred in our current culture and trying to derive ways in which we can bridge that divide. So my next question has to do with what Charles just talked about with the ideology. Do ideological beliefs or principles of a group, say the ideology of the Republican Party, do those beliefs or principles of a group matter as much to the group as what the leader wants, Donald Trump being the current leader of the Republican Party? Charles?
Well, leadership has a big cascading effect on issues. If a leader stands up that people like and says something that an individual would never consider, the wind seems to move in that direction. I mean, look at our current relationship, the way we perceive of Russia. I mean, that's a classic example. I mean, Russia has long been on our enemies list to treat with caution and now they can't seem to do anything wrong.
Which brings us to the big meeting that it seems to have everyone frightened that's going to occur tomorrow between Trump and Putin. What do you think is going to happen at that meeting?
I think Trump will cave. I posted a thing yesterday that Mike Huckabee said that it was going to be a meeting of two alpha males like Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. I said it's more like Michael Corleone meets an orange Fredo. And that,
Fredo wanted respect now. He didn't get it.
I totally agree with you, Charles. they aren't on equal footing. I mean, that's clear. That's been clear from way back. I mean, I was looking at some clips that they pulled up. First, they asked Trump, do you know Putin? Have you had any dealings with him? And he says, clearly no. Then they pull another clip out, and he's bragging about how well he knows Putin and how they get along. So it's like, you know.
They met on different segments of the 60 Minutes show. Putin was in one segment, Trump was in another segment, so that's how they met.
It's unbelievable. It's just.
Yeah. So what do you think about that, Pat? Ideological principles and beliefs of a group as opposed to what the leader wants. What do you think the group is more apt to follow, what the leader wants or its own principles?
I think as has been said, I think the leader has a tremendous power to influence what's happening. Hopefully groups pick leaders who have the underlying values of the group. If there's a mistake and they choose someone that may voice the words but not live it out, then I think it can sway the group aside. But I do think groups need to continually reaffirm their beliefs. If you don't just keep talking about the fact that this is what we believe, that I think that it fades into the sunset a little bit. And I think that's maybe one of the things that's happened with the Democratic Party. I think rather than continuing to reaffirm the belief in people, the belief in helping people, the belief in economic and social justice, those kinds of things, I think the Democrats, and I'm one, have taken for granted that everybody is with us. And I think, and I learned this when I was a principal, if you don't continually talk about and re-energize and reconsider what you're doing, you lose people. And so I think that may be what has happened to the Democrats. I think it probably has happened to the Republicans as well.
I think it's really interesting seeing both parties, because it really is go on what Pat was saying. Both parties are really changing now, if you really look. I mean, the Republican Party, look at what the Tea Party's doing. I mean, they aren't, you know, wanting to play ball with anyone. I mean, they certainly aren't, you know, following the party line with Trump. And if you think about Trump, he wasn't a Republican before he decided to run for office. So he's not a true Republican. During the campaign, he was actually agreeing with Bernie a lot of the times, you know. And so then we have the whole Bernie revolution in the Democratic Party. I mean, look at the split there, the fracture there. I mean, you have your old-time Democrats, and then you have the Progressive Caucus that's really out there fighting. They don't get a lot of press, don't get a lot of airtime, but they're out there plugging away.
What is it that Trump tapped into with this group known as the Republicans?
Fear. I mean, he's trapped into fear of especially among good-intentioned people who are not very well-educated, who see the world changing faster than they can get a grip on it, and they don't know what to do or who to turn to, and the quickest thing for them to do is find somebody to blame, and that's what they'll do.
Who'd they blame?
Some otherness. Uncertainty and otherness.
Obama, I guess, would be
Obama.
Other.
Yeah. Racial prejudice is big, and so is misogyny, and both of them are bound together. I mean, the degree of misogyny in the last election was incredible, and people dismiss it and give it short shrift, and it was incredible. I mean, you go back and read through some of the text of the things, and it's unbelievable that our media let this go by, and
what you were talking about earlier, Charles, about it being more it's not as overt as it was before. I mean, just take a look at our Senate and how our female senators are spoken to whenever Elizabeth Warren speaks up and says something, you know, how she's chastised.
Kamala Harris.
Exactly. How they're spoken to. I mean, they don't do that with the male senators. So, I mean, it's really, you know, kind of under, you know, under the radar a little bit, but it's there.
I don't think it's under the radar at all. I don't think it's ever been under the radar. I think we have not been good. We've been good at accepting it as it is without trying to fight it. And as a person who was, the first female principal at Palmer High, the first woman superintendent of the school district, people would go to my assistant principals who were men instead of me because, you know, there's just that you have to figure out and you have to be able to call it out and find out the time to call it out. But I really think this, the whole, I don't know, it's very scary how obvious it is because I think it isn't subtle now. I think it's much more obvious than it was. I think the subtlety has just like all, we can see it everywhere.
Well, it's in now to be that way, right. You know?
It's true.
So that what you're saying is the subtlety is gone and it's obvious now. Could it be that they didn't need to be subtle in the past because men had all the power, and then you coming on as a strong woman in these executive positions kind of emerged the issue where before they didn't exist because the men were in charge?
Well, misogyny has just been accepted as part of reality. That's the way things are. You know, I mean, and now we're going backwards.
That played a big part with Hillary Clinton. If you remember way back when she made the statement about she's not going to be at home baking cookies. I mean, here's a very well-educated, accomplished woman. And if she wanted to bake cookies, that's fine. If she didn't, that's fine, too. But she, you know, they beat up on her after that and never let her forget about that.
It boils down to the most qualified person ever to run for office ran against the most unqualified person ever run to office, and the man won.
He won, she lost. Yeah. What celebrated figures in today's political and entertainment world would you consider trustworthy? Do you know any politician you would consider trustworthy?
I like Elizabeth Warren. I think she does battle daily, and she's articulate. She has the facts. She doesn't give up, and I think that she is really a remarkable woman.
And has been slammed as Pocahontas.
Exactly.
She makes a better argument for economic justice than anybody does, and I would add Al Franken to that list.
I'd say Bernie.
Yeah, I would. Okay.
Bernie's been plugging away for a long time, and with the election, it seems like, you know, people are like, well, who's this Bernie? Who's this, you know, where did he come from? Bernie's been out there for a very, very long time fighting a good fight. You know, he hasn't been getting press.
How do we stop liberal conservative stereotyping? Because we just talked about Elizabeth Warren, we talked about Bernie, and Al Franken, but I would say Elizabeth Warren is probably the most demonized of that group. She's stereotyped as a liberal.
Pocahontas.
Trump calls her Pocahontas in order to demean her. How do we stop the stereotyping?
The Consumer Financial Protection Agency, I think that's the organization that she was head of, I think they've returned about $13 billion back to consumers because of that board that she set up. And she's out there fighting on behalf of us consumers. So Wells Fargo and all these big corporations don't continually rip us off on our mortgages and bank fees and all the, you know,
which
things
I
like
believe
that
came from
and
Dodd
those are the
Frank.
Facts. Those Dodd, are the facts. She's done that. Yeah.
Dodd-Frank, and they just repealed Dodd-Frank? Or they're in the process of repealing Dodd-Frank?
Yeah.
I don't believe we can convince the other side of our virtue or our aspirations. I think the only way to solve this is to take back the House and the Senate and the presidency and show these folks what a real country looks like.
So you're basically saying it's time for the electorate to get active? And
I think there are some conservatives right now that are reasonable people. There are some liberals that are unreasonable people. But I don't see how to break this. I don't see how to stop the relate. I don't see how to reason the relating. And if we can't relate to them, if you have to change emotion with emotion. You can't reason people out of hard, I mean, feelings.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I have argued with so many people for so long that I've pretty much quit it. I mean, there's just no point in it. It's just a waste of time. And preaching to the choir is okay if you can make the choir big enough.
Enough voters in the choir to win the election.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to fight voter suppression and all the new little things they're coming up with to try and prevent people from voting. I mean, the facts are that more Democrats have voted in the last few elections, but the Republicans are in control. Chairman, why is that?
That is the most dangerous thing. Voting oppression is the most dangerous thing out there to me. I mean, and this thing of trying to get all the voter rolls, I mean, my God, at least most of the states have enough sense not to do that.
Well, it's redistricting, too. It's gerrymandering.
Gerrymandering.
I mean, gerrymandering. And really, whoever was the grand schemer who has done this over time, one place at a time, has been very efficient. We need a long-term strategy
exactly.
like that. And I guess there's going to be something going to the Supreme Court this year about redistricting, gerrymandering in Wisconsin, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that Hillary Clinton would get 3 million more votes than Trump, not fraudulent ones, I'm pretty sure, 3 million more votes than Trump and lose the election and then have him say the American people chose him it's a travesty. I do think we need to look at the Electoral College. I don't think, even if you live in New York City, I don't think your vote should count less than if you live in Alaska. I just don't. I think we're all here together, and I think we're diminishing the power of people when we're saying, well, I'm sorry, you have fewer people, so your vote should count more. I think it's time to really think about that.
Wise men once said that two biggest mistakes that the founding fathers made with the original Constitution was slavery and the Electoral College. And whenever you have, in the election of 2000, the person that got the least votes still won. In the election of 2016, the person that got the least votes, so this time by 3 million, still won. That's a pretty good indicator.
Well, nothing could be more undemocratic than gerrymandering.
And all that ties back into voter suppression and interstate cross-check, faulty electronic voting machines where there's no paper trail. So what really matters is who's counting the vote. Doesn't really matter who votes, who's counting the votes. Is your vote being heard?
So do you believe that there is a possible inaccurate counting due to manipulation of voting machines?
Oh, I know there is, yeah. I'm originally from Missouri, and I remember when Obama first ran, how down in the city, people stood in line for 2-3 hours just waiting to vote. Out where I live, I just walked right in. There were, you know, no problems at all, no faulty machines, no nothing, you know. So there's a plan. I mean, the Republicans have really had a plan for, if you go back and look at some of the tapes from the 70s, they've had a plan. And this plan is being put into motion now, and it's paying off big time for them. So the Democrats really need to get on the same page and come up with a plan, too.
What would you suggest for that plan?
First, we need to start with voting, secure our vote. You know, a few years ago, they came out with the Help America Vote Act, and that was where we got these faulty electronic voting machines. The guy, the head of Diebold, said that his main goal was to make sure that back then that George Bush would be elected. So what does that tell you? That tells you there's no integrity of anything that they're putting out there if his main goal is to make sure a Republican is elected. We want to have fair elections.
We need to insist on a paper trail.
Exactly. At the minimum, at the least. I mean, there's all kind of things. Interstate cross-check, that's a big thing. They're now asking for secretaries of state to turn over their voter rolls, you know, so that's a big thing in the news I'm sure everybody's heard about. They do a thing called caging, what they've done for years with the military, and I was just heard a report today they're doing it, you know, just even not just with the military, but with other people. you know, well, they'll send you, if you get a postcard in the mail saying, you know, is this where you live? We're double checking this is where you live. Make sure you mail that back, because if you don't mail it back, they'll kick you off the voting rolls. So you really have to be careful about those things. It may look like junk mail, but really pay attention and just make sure you are on the voting rolls, because they're doing that. I don't know so much about Alaska, but other states, there are serious issues with that. Another thing they're doing with the cross check. Say you have Juan Fernandez in Ohio and Juan Fernandez in Kentucky, they're going to say he voted twice, so they're going to toss out his vote. You know, they're doing that a lot across this country. So a lot of people are being disenfranchised, and their votes are not counting. So we really need to pay attention. There are lawsuits going on right now. Korean-American organization has filed a lawsuit down in Georgia because so many Korean-Americans, Asian-Americans, were tossed off the voter rolls just because they had the same name. May have been a different middle name, different Social Security number, but you have the same name, they're tossing you off, they're not counting your vote.
That is voter suppression, clearly. We are at KVRF, Radio Free Palmer, and we're having a discussion here with some members of the local community about the politics that divide us and ways in which we can bridge that divide. So, Charles, you had – oh, I'm sorry, Pat, go ahead.
Can I just add one more thing? You know, when I ran for office, I walked from, you know, place to place and talked to a lot of people, and I talked to a great many of people who don't vote. And the reasons were interesting. I don't know enough to vote. I really should know more. I don't really care. My vote doesn't make any difference. So I think that that's the other part of the scenario is, you know, I know that there's a lot of get out the vote thing. But to make people feel confident that they can make an informed decision is really difficult. You can read the little blurb that people put in the Alaska whatever it is, little election booklet, but it really doesn't tell you much about anybody. You can say whatever you want in there. You just pay and you pay your money and you put whatever is in there. And I think that this whole issue of the media and trying to find a balance and really all that stuff all plays into how do you get the word out to people. You know, if you were to ask one question of a candidate, what would you ask? I think that's one of the issues that we have going for us, too. And then we might be able to talk about this whole tribalism, too. You know, what do you want for yourself? What do you want for your children? And who's going to do it, not just say it, but do it?
Okay, I believe we have three Democrats in here. Is that correct?
Independent.
Okay, independent, okay. But leaning towards the Democrat.
Nonpartisan.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, anyway, I just got a question from Mike here, and question is this. So if the answer in bridging the divide, which what we're about here today, is that about winning the next election? Is it about putting together a plan for the Democrats to win the next election? Is that the answer to bridging the divide? Because we want to try to find out what it is that none of us understand about the Trump voter that makes that person in that particular tribe. So you talk about winning election. What do you say about that, Charles?
I think that's the only practical way. I don't see how we're going to break the barrier of tribalism. I don't see how we're going to – how. I mean, I can't comprehend the mind of a Trump supporter to see that man as being presidential. Something is wrong with my head. It just won't it's incomprehensible to me that they can believe that – look at that man and say, this person deserves to be president of the United States. I mean, a leader, at the very least, has to have the best interest of the people at heart. And he clearly doesn't, never has. And if you can't see through that, I don't know how to get you to see through it. The only way I know to change things is to really change things and then let people see how living wages and equal opportunity actually works out.
But didn't we have that with Obama? Wasn't Obama radically, radically different from Trump? And yet there were a lot of Obama voters that voted for Trump. How do we explain that?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know that I can explain it. I think one of the things that happened, I'm sure the racial issue is part of it, but I also think Obama did not do enough to continually reaffirm Democratic values and really talk about social justice, talk about those things all the time. And he's an articulate man. And when he did speak, he spoke well, but that needed to be all of the time. And the Democratic Party needed to be talking all of the time. That's what the Republicans have been doing. They talk all of the time, and they keep saying the same old, they are the ones with family values. They're the ones that, you know, support the worker. By the way, we're going to have this right to work thing, which means the only you have a right to work for whatever money I pay you. This whole issue, we have to get the language down. We have to get the messages out. And I guess I would go back to when I ran for office again, because one of the things that I thought we should do then, and I think we should do now, is that I think Democrats should have a message that they share. I don't think I should have to craft my own. I think we should have, here's our message. That's what the Republicans do, and they stick to it. Listen to them. You know, you go and you listen to Kathy Tilton and Shelley Hughes and all those people. They say the same thing all of the time, and we need to do it too. And we need to do it based on our values, our what we think is important. People need to be able to support their kids. We want their kids to be smart. We want them to build those robots, not just have their jobs taken away from. You know, we, anyway.
So as a talking point, can you put a couple talking points together here for what that message would be?
Well, I do think we have to say that we're the party that cares about you and wants to help you succeed. We want you to be successful. It doesn't take away from me. If you have money, I want you to have money. I want you to be able to afford what you want. I want you to be able to send your kids to college. That's what I'm going to work toward, is trying to have you get those things.
Living wages, universal health care, and equal opportunity. How about that?
Not just opportunity, but you have to sometimes, it's not equal, it's equitable opportunity.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to be the same for everybody. Right.
Because you have some people that work very hard, and they look at their neighbor who does not work hard, who is a low life, if I could use that term, and they get all these welfare benefits, their PFD or whatever, and there's that otherness looking at that. How do you convince that person who is working hard, who is not happy about the fact that his neighbor is not working hard, that they should be given what we have to fight for and work for?
The irony is the situation that there are people in the lower and upper echelons of economic world that are deadbeats. I mean, they're takers, whatever you call them. But to arrange society in such a situation to be punitive to them so bad that you make it bad for everybody else is insane. And that's what we do. Well, the divide is so great in this country that when President Obama would make he made speeches every once in a while that it would absolutely give you goosebumps. And then you listen to the radio the next day, and they said, well, he hated America. You know, I mean, how do you get over that? I mean, how do you...
I think what you asked a few minutes ago when you said, do you think your president cares about you? I mean, just look, do you really think Trump cares about you? Just look at all the executive orders he's signed since he's been in office. Look at what's going on with the Education Department. Look at the EPA. Look at the health care. Do you really think he cares about you as a citizen?
Well, yes, but we have to pose it in such a way is that how... Do you think he cares about you? Yes. In what ways? Tell me what he's done that has proven to you that he cares about you. Because if we go on and point out our perspective, that's just not listening to what they're really thinking, I think.
So you need to further the discussion with details on which you can either prove your point or disprove their point.
Yeah. Well, you need to frame it in their values, too. I mean, whenever I talk about health care, I always bring the armed services into it and the men and women who've died on the battlefield, who've had relatives die because they couldn't get health care. Now, conservatives don't like that. You know, you have to get into that area, something that they can really relate to some people who are related.
And what is the biggest insurer of all the insurance companies for health care? What is the biggest insurer?
Medicaid.
Well, the federal government.
Yeah.
Because we have Medicare, We have Medicaid. We also have VA.
The VA.
Yep.
And Native Health. We have that's a federal too.
We have a few minutes to go, so if there's anything you'd like to say in closing, we'll start with you, Lynette.
I'll say I really, you know, despite all the negativity going on now, I really do have hope, you know. And what Charles was saying, it's a really emotional time for the country, and I really understand that. But I do have hope that people will see the light and see what's going on around them and say, this is not right. We're not on the right path here. And we all can work together to, you know, have a great country, something that we can all believe in and be proud of.
Charles?
Do your homework and vote.
Pat?
Talk less, listen more.
Get out there and get active.
I want to thank you all for coming by today. It was a wonderful discussion, and I do hope that we can all gather again in another time and continue this discussion. Next time, I'd like to talk about some of the details about what would be economically just in our healthcare system. So that said, we'll let it go. I want to thank Mike and everybody here at the radio station, Radio Free Palmer, for giving us this opportunity. This is Paul Thomas. So long.